Hello and welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. This is Craig.
This is Renee.
Hello, Tony. Tony, you out there?
Tony.
And Tony's on what we call assignment in the radio industry. Well, he's not here anyway.
I think he's having a fun on a beach, which is not his normal beach.
A different beach.
A different beach. So he lives on an island and he went to have a holiday on a different island.
Okay. Anyway, enough about Tony. It's just about you and I today, Renee.
Excellent.
So let's get down to business. What are you seeing in the world of Agile over the last couple of weeks?
As always, I don't read Agile stuff. It's way too boring. I've been reading a lot about motivation recently. There was a Modern Survey had a article written about motivation. It had a number of interesting metrics inside of it. And those metrics are 70%, 21%, and 73%. The first, 70%, is the percentage of full-time US workers at organisations with 100 or more employees that are under-engaged or totally disengaged.
So what was that percentage again?
70.
70.
Yes, 70.
70 unengaged.
Or disengaged.
What did you say again? Oh, sorry, I was just wrong. 70.
Yeah, so the next number, 21%, is the number of workers who are actively looking for a new job. So of that 70%, only 21 is actually looking for a new job. So 50% of people are just hanging around disengaged.
Right. So you at least explain the 21% are disengaged because they're on the job boards, you know, looking for something to do, which means they're not getting our stuff done. The others are just, what, playing solitaire and...
Yeah, exactly. So it talks about the fact that due to the economic crisis, people just aren't... They know they can't get a job anywhere else. There's no jobs out there. So they're just hanging around.
So they'd just be unhappy where they are.
Yep.
Right, there you go. It'd be interesting if you correlate that, if there was no GFC, to see whether the amount of people that were looking for a job was up or... I just wonder whether that actually really has anything to do with anything, whether there's just a large percentage of the population who hate their job or just go to work to...
Well, I mean, it's increased in the last year. I mean, a year ago, it was only 59%. And 6 months ago, 65%. So it's dramatically jumped by 11% in the last year.
So I wonder if that actually just has to do with the fact that, you know, they people, because of the economic times, they're just feeling, out of sorts and...
Or maybe we're just not managing people well. We keep being bozos.
No. Management's fine. No, you can't hear the sarcasm in my voice. You can't see me making those hand signals, can you?
No. The last figure is the 73%. And just trying to find the link. The percentage of people who responded favourably to the question, I can honestly say I'm working up to my potential on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So this 70% group that are disengaged are saying, yeah, but I'm working to my potential.
Which is nothing.
Or very little. Apparently.
But I tell you what, I've got a high score here on Angry Birds.
It's interesting for me reading that article because it ties into a book that I'm actually reading at the moment called Reality is Broken. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Jane McGonigal. For those listeners, I'm...
How old's the book?
It's only a couple of years old.
Okay, so originally.
Quite new. It's got a lot of really interesting metrics inside it as well about the gaming industry. So for those listening, I'm a self-confessed geek.
A geek, well, and gamer. I thought you were going to go gamer there, but...
Well, gamer equals geek, doesn't it, these days?
Maybe.
So
you see my thumbs? These are my Xbox thumbs from the weekend, so...
So I play a lot of... big scale games. I've sort of gave it up half a year ago to focus on more other activities, but the book really hit home to me on the motivation front and a lot of the psychological elements. And so I'm about a third of the way through the book. I'm absolutely loving it. But what I find interesting is that the precepts of the book are saying basically that we don't like reality anymore. And the reason that we don't like reality more, it's just not fun. You know, it's not engaging. If you compare it to games, there are many facets of games that are engaging to us in comparison, and that what we should be doing as an industry of software developers is making sure, and this is the tie to Agile, eventually got there, is making sure that we're developing products that are actively engaging for the end user. It's not about usability, it's about fun.
Do you think that's because the games, and I guess even maybe movies and television to that, if I add that those genres in, are just so immersive now, like potentially to what they were? I mean, things are so much easier to get to, but if you look at games, the quality of the realism and the immersion.
Yeah, I'd certainly say the immersion is high, but what is leading you to go sit on the couch and watch the TV to be immersed? What are you escaping from?
But I would even argue that televisions and movies, at least the good ones, are probably more immersive as well, because now, at least here in Australia, you can't turn on any show without Twitter and Facebook links popping up down the bottom of the screen. And I know quite often I'll be watching something and you're watching the Twitter stream going by, so you're still immersing yourself with all those other people.
But what are we escaping from whilst we're immersing ourselves in there?
I don't think it's any different to what we were doing in the past. I think it's just different things that people have always had to have some escape to get away from.
Families?
Well, families, everyday life, your problems in the world, whatever they might be. Movie theatres were traditionally that. The radio was traditionally that. I think we just changed the things that we're immersing from. I think the difference is, though, that it's a lot easier for people to get to, and they're a lot more immersive.
Mm.
Meaning that
you can... Addictive?
Yeah, I'd say so. The immersion gives you the addiction.
Yeah.
So, you can feel like, when you play, the games like you do, that you're actually part of that world.
So why can't we be addicted to work?
Well, I think you can be. But this comes back to your question before, is that, it's making it more fun. And if you think about things like, the tool that we're going to look at a bit later, for example, the Agile tool, where people are trying to sort of, game the things a little more. A lot of things we do in Agile are about, building fun. I know fun was never written into the manifesto, but that is a byproduct of a team. It's a team that has fun together, right? Which means that you want to get up and come to work in the morning.
And I know that we have fun as a question on our Agile maturity assessment. Why do you think that is? Is that relationship?
Well, like any of those types of questions that you ask, it's really trying to get to an underlying theme. So, we've done surveys in the past where they've had, do I have a best friend at work? Doesn't necessarily mean that you need your best pal at work, but it's that sense of feeling, and asking people if they're having fun at work is also that sense of feeling. I mean, if you ask those same people, do you like going to work, right? If they all won lotto the next day, would everybody come back in? Right? Maybe not. But if you're gonna be spending 40, 50 hours, 60 hours a week doing something,
you might as well have fun.
Yeah, it might as well have some potential. So if you read a lot of this stuff coming out from, not only here in the Agile community, but the Lean Startup and all the umbrellas around that, it's more about actually saying, well, you've got to treat it like it's your being, it's your place, it's the thing that you're getting some reward from. And if not, then maybe it's time to find your own passion or time to move on.
Yeah, so I'm going to make the ballsy prediction here that whilst we're focusing predominantly these days on usability, that in the future we'll be focusing more on making it fun and rewarding and drawing the user into the system.
Yeah, I think so. And if you think of the types of companies even that you want to do business with, the types of companies that give you some reward or value, you like, I've been with my bank for 20 years type statement, used to cut it. Now it's, which organisation, like which bank is going to give me, is going to reward me for being a customer? What organisation is
going to give me some benefits? I would love to go up to a teller for a bank, for example, and opt to choose the fun mode on the teller, and it would have like a little virtual
beep, 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 beep. Accessing fun mode.
Well, exactly, like a virtual poker machine or whatever, and you get to pull down the virtual lever, and it pops up these letters, and if you match, you actually win a prize at the same time as taking money out.
Isn't that the casino?
That is, but I would like a bank to be able to give me, one in $100,000 chance that I get an extra $5 or something out of the system, or do you know what I mean? Something to encourage me to visit the teller more often, I think, is slightly scary, but an idea.
Which goes against what every bank is doing. But
giving money out, you mean?
Well, no, you're making people go into a branch. But
right.
But
okay, so tie it to this then. Rather than get $5 out of it, say that you get, go into a branch and get a movie ticket, for example. So that would force you to actually go into the branch.
Well, use the online system, and you know, and if you and every time you make a payment, you know, you go into the winning to win something, or you get points for using, you know, if you're using that bank, which, you know, you can credit out later or something along those lines.
Yep. So I saw an interesting post about a month and a half ago of SAP. They were trying to introduce gaming into some of their applications as well. So I saw a really interesting application where it was about a sales management system, and you can allocate sales jobs to certain sales managers, and the way in which the user does that is that they play a little golf game. So each sales manager has a little hole in a golfing green, and you actually have to putt the golf ball into this is
radio. For those who can't see, Renee's sitting here actually simulating a golf swing right now
into the hole in order to give it to that particular sales manager. So fun in order to allocate a task.
Yeah, I mean, there is the danger that you turn it into being a little bit, you know, a little bit too gamesy, or you know, something goes over top. I mean, some different things appeal to different people, right? Like, for example, a golf game is something that doesn't necessarily appeal to me. So I can think, if I was a salesperson in that company, well, I'd probably shoot myself.
So,
but
so
if it was a salesperson.
In this instance, though, I mean, if you could choose the gaming mode, you would then have a race car driver where you'd actually be able to choose this particular driver going, I don't know, to a certain location.
Possibly. I think this comes back to all the... It's using the metrics that you have and putting them more in a fun way. Like, you know, if you're flipping burgers at McDonald's, right, you have an order system above you that says, you know, 3 Big Macs now, please, right? But, you know, if you're gaming with the guy across the counter to, you know, how many Big Macs you could flip or how fast you could get them out, then there might be some element to it, and you could get prizes for the fact that, you know, you're not letting wastage happen, or I don't know, whatever. I've never worked at McDonald's, but whatever, you know, those type of metrics that they're trying to reduce their employees doing, the things that they're trying to increase, and you make that into a game rather than just a, you know, stock standard dashboard, or even worse, nothing at all, where there's just a computer in the background, and all of a sudden 3 weeks later your manager comes up to you and goes, hey, you better do better than that, you're not flipping enough burgers. And the guy goes, well, I didn't even know about it. So I think in Agile we've done a good job of making things visible.
Yeah, and
but it's now taking, I think, to the next level.
And four elements of the game, one of those elements is the feedback system. So that adaptive loop that we have, inspect, adapt, and retrospectives, that's a key element to a very successful game, one of four.
So do you think when we look at walls that perhaps, or stand-ups where people aren't quite as engaged, sometimes, it, you know, maybe we need to do a better job of making it more fun?
Yeah, definitely. We play games as we train. Why don't we play games all the time?
Yeah. And little things. I mean, I know, you know, we've used things where, you know, you throw footballs around and, you know, all those kind of things. But you're right, maybe there's even more of a gaming element to, you know, the team. You know, if they get the stand-up done in under 10 minutes, they, you know, they get some team points. And if they get, you know, more than 90% of the story points completed, they get credit towards something. I don't know.
Fandangle. The other three elements of a really good game, one is voluntary participation, which goes back to the comment that you made in the last podcast about, you know, if you're going to be there, be there.
Mm.
Make sure that you want to be there, that they're really actively engaging yourself rather than taking yourself out of the picture. The third one is around goals. And I think we do that fairly well in defining a sprint goal, but maybe could do it better.
Yeah, I know I've always in the past tried to actually give a theme to a sprint or an iteration, but try to make that theme a little bit fun.
Mm. So it's a sense of purpose.
Mm.
And the last one is rules in place. So we've got plenty of those rules.
Yeah, but I still think sometimes that those rules aren't as easily accessible. If you're playing a computer game, it's pretty easy because for the rules, because the game will either warn you, you'll lose a life or those kind of things if you do that. But it's not to the point that's detrimental. So yeah, it's more that penalty and reward system, which is quite interesting, where, especially with social contracts, where penalties sometimes feel like, you know, you're getting shot and you're really being shot, as opposed to, you know, losing a life, so to speak. So I think there's a lot we can learn from that. Oh no, we just put it all in Second Life and be done with it.
Excellent. I'm done.
Awesome. A little bit of news. This is probably more Australian-centric, but something coming out from Software Education saying that there's STANS and SDC conferences. So STANS is a software testing conference here in Australia, New Zealand, and the SDC conference, which is their BA conference, they're cancelling them after 10 years.
Cancelling them?
Yes. Did you hear that news?
I might have, yes.
Yeah, so apparently they're still running STANS in New Zealand. It's actually quite popular in New Zealand, but yeah.
That's shocking news. Why are they doing that?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I guess I was at STANS this year. The attendance was probably lower than what they were expecting. SDC, I think the same. But I don't like to see any conference go away. There was certainly good elements to it. And whilst it's not completely agile related, they do have a lot of agile type topics in both those conferences. So hopefully something comes in and fills the void. Anyway, interesting article from the Pragmatic Agilist about iteration showcases for back-end systems. So the whole premise, and I actually like the wording. In fact, I'm going to read just a little bit from here, is that let's just say that you're in charge of the services operation within the IT department of a large enterprise. You're a government entity, a telecommunications giant, or some other titan of industry. Other IT organizations have grown up around you in the enterprise over time and are writing cute little front ends that get information from customers to your services and pass the results back. They're doing iPods and tablets, and you're still dealing with COBOL. Your colleagues are still concerned with cascading style sheets and user experience and color schemes and the like, but you're doing all the grungy, large-scale back-end work that actually causes the money to pour into your organization and keep you all paid. And suddenly one day you get an edict that your enterprise is going to be agile. You get a perky trainer, most likely bringing with her stickers, pipe cleaners, and brightly colored balloons, and explains that the brave new world you're entering, you'll now be demonstrating your software to your customers every 2 weeks.
Wait, is that talking about me?
You don't use pipe cleaners.
Oh.
It would be a feel-good moment for you and for them.
So I don't have to deal with back-end systems.
That's right. And this is where you break it to Miss Perky that you have no user interface. There is nothing to show, and it goes on. But I kind of like the setting for that, because that's how a lot of these teams, whether they be middleware or back-end or infrastructure teams, see it, right? They see this agile thing showcasing, and they go, well, I've got nothing to show. I can't show you building half a server. I can't show you some interface that's half written. So there's some...
How do they fix it?
There is some suggestions here, Renee.
Excellent.
The first one, and they're pretty obvious, but I think it's I just like this article. It's nice, short, and sweet, and something that I hand on to some of the back end teams that I work with. So the first one is to pair up. So actually pair up with your front end customer, and that's something that we do try to do a lot in agile teams. Is instead of having a disparate front end and a back end team, have a cross functional team.
Yep.
Sometimes that's not always the case. There's reasons why sometimes you can't do that. So if that is not the case, that you couldn't actually make a feature team on your own, then pair up with them. So build and demo the stories together, so that they'll be showing that slick front end, but you can be there and go, hey, there's the back end that's actually holding that up, right? Especially when you get those front end teams that kind of show you, hey, it doesn't do anything in the back end, and then all of a sudden people start pointing fingers at you. The second one is to create viewable mocks or stubs, which I think is something that I don't see enough of from these types of teams. So actually
build fake front ends?
Well, it's more for testing, because a lot of these back end systems, particularly the COBOL ones, sometimes we don't have enough environments, sometimes they're not as accessible, especially when the front ends are away doing all their groovy unit testing and all those type of things. So by making those, it means that they're actually testing against the mock of your system, but you should own that mock, not them writing one. So you control it. So if you want to change it, you can actually see what's coming through. And the third one is, if you've got to go and show them a PowerPoint of a log file flashing across the screen, right? So when they say, what have you guys been doing? Then say, well, here's the number of transactions that have come through our environment, and just fire a file off and give them some stats and some meaningful things that actually mean something to them.
You might want to grip it so that they can actually see it, though.
Yeah, although there is something interesting about just seeing stuff flying across the screen. I remember quite a few years ago, I went to a computer centre, and we were watching ATM transactions. And the thing that almost everybody on the tour was remarking at was there was just a big old black screen sitting there. It was an old-fashioned monitor, and just had things flying past the screen. And someone said, what's that? And he goes, that's the number of transactions going through our ATM network at the moment. And all of a sudden, you just went, holy crud. Right, it's not just...
So it was much similar to the Twitter feed recently for Qantas.
It's still going.
If you ever try and actually open up hashtag Qantas right now, you can't read anything.
Yes, hopefully that'll be old news by the time this podcast gets out. But yeah, like any of those things that are going viral, it just flies by seeing the screen. So anyway, some good advice if you're a back end system. But if you've got things that you do, if you're in that kind of team, hey, drop us a line. We'd love to hear what things you do to get through there. The other one I had was, this one's a little bit geeky, but something I thought was pretty cool was Atlassian, one of my favourite companies. Well, they've actually gone through a logo redesign. I don't know whether you've seen that. Relaunched their logo during the week, and there's actually a whole article up there about how they designed it. It's a bit of a refresh.
No, I haven't seen it. Yeah, okay.
But that's not what I was here to actually talk about.
Oh, as a side note for listeners, it's like this big X with this three... Wait.
Yeah, the man's called Atlas, and he's old, and he was holding up the world. But there was lots of reasons why people would get that confused. They couldn't actually understand what it was. So there's an article on their blog about how they went through the redesign, but they've changed the font. In reading that article, just from memory, they said the font was actually a Windows font, which was kind of ironic given the type of development and type of developers they have. So they changed that. And they changed the logo.
Did they do this as part of a FedEx day?
That I don't know, but they did it in a very crowdsourced type of way. There's a great article that actually takes you through the entire process and what was really interested in it. Anyway, that's not what I was here to talk about. It's just something interesting. But this one was about using an Apple TV as a wallboard monitor, and it's something that probably seems maybe obvious to people, but it was sort of I was reading down there and went, yeah, and then I went, that's actually quite interesting. So... I work with lots of teams where if they're lucky enough, they get a plasma, and typically in a work environment, if you get a plasma, someone wants to hang it on a wall, right? Which is fine, but they just hang the plasma there. And then all of a sudden the team goes, well, we wanted to show our build results or something like that. So what ends up happening is some crungy old PC gets plugged into it that's sitting on the floor and gets tripped over and never gets updated, and someone's got to log into it. So this article is actually saying that they're being shown to use Apple TVs at Atlassian to do this. And if you know anything about the Apple TV, it's the size of a deck of cards type thing, two decks of cards. It's pretty thin. And essentially, they've just got this thing zip tied to the back of the monitor because it's so small. Now, to get around it, and they talk about the fact that there's actually two reasons why they did this. One, they had been using old laptops and desktops, and they were using Mac Minis. And the nice thing about the Apple TV, while they originally went and looked at it, is because it only uses about 8 watts of power. Of course, your mileage might vary. But the real thing was the fact that they could just zip tie it to the back of the screen, so actually all the unsightly cables and everything went away. And to get around that, they did that. You actually have to hack the Apple TV. So there's a little piece of software called Firecore, which turns it into a browser. But I just thought it was a nice little hack that actually makes it kind of usable. So we're taking a look at. But I've just seen way too many teams that either don't use their plasmas or they're very unsightly because they're way too hard to get information onto them. This might just be in
something. Yeah, I read it and I thought it was a brilliant way of making more information big and visible within the environment.
Absolutely. So the Apple TV, take a look at that post if you're interested, but I think it's an interesting little one. The last one I have got is just a little article about unit tests and how do you tell, and it's kind of in the vein of an old Jeff Foxworthy type gag, it's not a unit test. So why is it not a unit test? It's not a unit test if it requires manual setup, if it requires manual intervention, if it requires a network connection, if it requires a container, a database, a file system, or a service to be available. If it takes longer than a millisecond to run, Renee, it is not a unit test. If it lacks assertions, it's not a unit test. If it breaks on certain dates or certain times, it's not a unit test. If it requires a UI, it is not a unit test. That's a pet peeve of mine. Right?
Wait, how do you test the UI though?
Not for a unit test, that's a functional test. Yes. If it fails intermittently for an unknown reason, that's just a intermittent failing test. It's not a unit test. If it fails when you look at it funny, that's not a unit test. If the mock setup code dwarfs the actual test code, it's not a unit test. And if you have to mock beyond immediate dependencies, it's not a unit test.
So basically, if you need anything else, it's not a unit test.
It just has to be small, right? Wrap the piece of code you're testing, should run all the time, it's a unit test. Now, I know people are going to flame me now. I welcome your letters. Right, they're going to say to me, there's all these other things that make up a unit test. But it's a nice one just to read from. Sometimes remind yourself, I guess, what is a unit test. And if you look through and any of those things your unit tests are doing, might be worth having a bit of a look at them. So
it's a nice opportunity to have a couple of segues then on code.
Segue away, Renee.
The definition of done should define minimum for checked in code beyond compilation, no dead code, commented out code, or to-dos.
I'm not sure I agree completely about the to-do. Depending, I guess it all depends on your definition.
If you've done a story, should there be any to-dos?
Depending on your definition of a to-do.
Okay.
Because if your to-do is actually keeping perhaps things that need refactoring, but you know, they're not quite related to the code that you're doing right now, maybe they're a to-do. I would say that you put a different tag on them. You don't call them to-dos, you call them refactors or fixes or something like that.
I just liked it because too often when we're talking about a story being done, we talk about the functional elements of what entails that being done, but we never have a social contract agreement to say, other than functional done, what is software craftsmanship done?
Well, I guess maybe it's the teams that you work in. I certainly know teams I worked in the past, we've had that. Like there is a developer social contract, and it does say things like that, like, all the code must be checked in, you must... you must have comments on your check-in. It must link back to the original ticket. You shouldn't have any to-dos left over. All those kind of things. I guess that's probably my to-do thing's probably going around in my mind from a conversation I had with someone last week. In that, I'm getting consistently annoyed with walking past story walls where there is tech debt walls, mm-hmm. and you ask the developers, you know, what are you doing to resolve this tech debt? And actually no one on the team can remember what the tech debt is.
What do you mean? How are you aware that there's tech debt?
So I've seen teams where they do a bit of a risk wall type rating. So it's kind of a matrix from the things that are easy to fix and easy to knock over through to things that have got big impact but are harder to fix. They have it on a bit of a matrix. And I see these on walls quite often. But I was in a stand-up the other week where they were talking about they've had a bit of time on the sleeve so they could tackle some tech debt, and all the developers looked at the tech debt wall and couldn't remember what the stuff was on there. I had another scenario a few years ago, about a year ago now, with a team where they weren't even getting to the point that they were putting stuff on the tech debt wall. So they put this nice elaborate tech debt wall there but put nothing on there, because you're in code, last thing you think about is, oh, I'd better go write a card for that piece of tech debt. You either fix it or you go, someone else will fix it.
But isn't that a discipline? It's about writing, making sure that there is a car there for that tech debt.
Maybe, but when you're in the throes of development, the last thing you're thinking about is actually writing a card to put it on a wall. You're worried about the code. So tech debt is something
that... I think that's
a cop-out. No, I think it lives in the code. So instead of writing a card, write a comment in the code. Write a fixed comment, because then you can start to track it. If every time you come across a piece of tech debt that you're not going to fix right now, put a tech debt fix against it. Right, tech debt. At some point, we should refactor this.
So why aren't you just refactoring it?
Sometimes things are just too large or unwieldy or not in the area that you're looking. Maybe you're looking at another piece of code that's not related at all. You're just saying, hey, how did Joe do this over here? And all of a sudden you go, wow, this thing's unreadable. And you might leave a trail behind to go, hey, we should go and clean this up.
Well, the reason why is that we talk about visibility all the time. If you put it in the code, where's the visibility?
So then you can count those things up, right? And you can start to get a visibility of how much tech debt's getting being left behind. Especially on teams where you are focused on that delivery, where perhaps the pressure is that you can't get back to refactoring. So I was going to say right now.
So all I'm saying though here is that you're saying visibility in something that you have to seek out to get the answer, as opposed to something that you force someone to write that's on a wall that's in transparent.
That's right. Put it closer to the source, right? Because at the end of the day, when someone else comes along and reads that code that's not sitting next to your wall, they're going to read and see that comment in there. Now, I'm just going to point out straight here is that yes, you should refactor as close as possible to the source, right? We all agree to that. We all subscribe to that. I'm not suggesting that, but the reality of the situation is that you can't always do that. So make it more visible. So one of the things I like to see is put the comment in the code, and leave that behind, right? Put a tag in there.
So I'll do my second segue. There's a quote from Kent Beck. A comment is the code's way of asking to be made more clear.
Oh no, I completely agree with that. There's comments through your code then, and if you haven't read Uncle Bob's book on clean code, then go read it about naming things appropriately. If you've got a comment in there, it probably means that the codes are very clear. Perhaps the variable name's not clear. The only thing I think comments need to be left in there for is if there's really an explanation for something that perhaps can't be left behind in code. Like maybe there is something daft in there because some downstream...
Well, apparently tagged it.
Well, no, sometimes you've got some downstream API that you can't explain. So you have to pass, 57 parameters to it and someone looking through it at a glance would go, why the heck are you doing that? Sometimes you're forced into things. So that's about the only time I can see that comments actually add any value. But yes, a comment is usually an indicator for something that could be better written. I've got a couple of quick quotes. This one was retweeted so many times I actually lost where the source was from, but this is essentially just a leadership one saying that anyone can start something new, but it takes real leaders to stop something old.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, yes, we're real good at starting things up, but actually the real power is actually in stopping things.
Yeah, I wonder how many of the population are completer finishers. There's a high portion of us out there that love to start new shiny things, but then just don't have the passion to follow through on it, and consequently there's plenty of things on the go, but not a lot that's actually being done, and a leader that will actually look at that and say, is this really going to give us the value that we're expecting? Won't kill it off.
Well, I think also sometimes people are afraid to kill things off just because the effort it took to start something up.
Mm.
I noticed recently a team I've been coaching, we killed a project. Right?
Yay!
Hey, high five! But the amount of effort it took to convince the leaders there that was the right thing to do, it's like, oh, but we've got all the people and all the effort, and it's like, but you're burning money.
But they've been convinced for so many months that we need to do this, we need to do this.
Absolutely. But they also knew that they were spending money on the wrong thing. Right? In that particular case, they didn't have the resources lined up, they didn't have the right people in the right places, so we're making do with the people they had. And so in the end, it was just spinning wheels. The other quote I've got is one from my good friend Patrick Starr, if you've ever seen SpongeBob SquarePants.
No.
Patrick Starr is the Patrick lives under a rock next to SpongeBob. He said a quote here, I'll procrastinate later. I don't have time right now. I just thought that was funny. Next up, Renee, what's our next feature?
We were going to talk about dead walls.
We've actually talked a bit about dead walls already just in passing, haven't we?
We have.
So my tech dead walls that annoy me.
Yep. I must admit that one of my pet peeves are around dysfunctional walls. In particular, I guess the biggest issue that I see are walls that have cards that don't move, or walls that just aren't being updated, or people aren't using it for the efforts that they're meant to be using it for, which, you know, shows that it's not providing the value in that particular instance.
Yeah, I think a lot of people put walls, especially when they go down their agile track, they put walls up because that's kind of that visibility to go, hey, look, I'm doing agile.
Yeah.
And really, it's only value. The best walls I've seen are not the ones that look pretty or whatever. They're the ones that just kind of, you know, a bunch of people standing around a wall going, right, we've got to plan this and let's put stuff up. And I've done a couple of social experiments on this. I was doing a FedEx day a few years ago now, where we were fairly new into the agile adoption in this particular area. So purposely in this FedEx day, we wanted them to do some innovation and I wanted them to work in an agile way. But as soon as I even mentioned the A word, right, people would roll their eyes.
Yep.
So I said to them, look, I kind of gave them a bit of a framework. They had an iteration zero, which I didn't call that. It was like a preparation time box where they had 60 minutes to prepare this. And essentially, they had to build PCs and move desks. And at the end of it, they had to show me their plan. And then they had three time boxes, which were revolved around breaks and ends of days and all those kind of things, where at the end of it, you know, they could go back and replan. And so I had an agile feel to it, but we never used the word. You know, the interesting thing was that in this iteration zero, I said to them, all I want to do is I want to see your plan. So interesting, one team went away and they started trying to use PowerPoint.
Right? Okay.
And they just stumbled over themselves because in the time, you know, they just couldn't quite get the PowerPoint plan up and running. There's this other guy that actually came up and said to me, hey, do we need to use this agile thing? And I went, no, I don't care, I just want to see a plan. He said, that's good. I don't like that agile thing. That's a load of rubbish. By the way, can I borrow some post-it notes, please? And off he went and started putting things up on the wall as they started the plan. I'm standing there going, yeah, if only you knew, pal. And that's what I see all the time, right, is that the best ones are the ones where people just stand around trying to plan something. And yeah, they start scribbling on a piece of paper or a whiteboard. But in the end, if you want to get a lot of people across a plan, best thing is put a big bit of butcher's paper up. And then all of a sudden you realize that's not going to scale. So you go, well, let's just put some post notes because we can rip them up and move them around. And people have to actually have to have that aha moment, you know. And that's why I really hate a lot of these tools, because they simulate that, but people don't get the simulation. Until you've actually moved cards around physically and ripped them up and teared them down, then you can actually figure out how the tools work. If you just go and work in straight with a tool, or just come into a team where they're moving cards around, you don't actually get there, you know, you actually haven't been in the assembling and putting it up, then you don't ever really get it.
I don't know about you, but when I look at a wall, sometimes I'm actually overjoyed when I see scribbly cards, because it indicates to me that it was something that was done in haste and anxious. It was sort of like, oh, we're having a stand-up. Oh, we forgot about that, and they'll scribble it up. But at least they're doing that. They're doing that action of that discipline of making sure that everything's captured. I look at pretty walls and I suspect that they're not being used the way that they should be being used.
Yeah, whenever you see pre-printed cards and all those kind of things, I mean, so they're okay. I mean, if you've done the planning and the tool you've got prints things out and it's quicker to do that, then that's cool. But you're right, it should be supplemented with a bunch of, you know, handwritten things and post-it notes hanging off the side of the wall, and, you know, and all of a sudden that new column that you wanted to add just kind of appears. So you're almost kind of a mix of a nice-looking wall and a hastily put-together type wall.
I actually think some of the best approaches that I've seen as far as walls are concerned is one is a wall that has an idea about what the release is and where we might be going with the release, but a wall that also shows where you're going inside the iteration, so you've got a really clear goal. So, in fact, using two walls and making sure that both are being well talked to.
Well, not necessarily two walls, but you're right. You need to see the what we're doing now, and you've got to see the where we're going.
The backlog, yeah.
And whether that is a full release wall, whether that's just a backlog, or whether that's even just a picture that says, hey, we're 37% through and we've done the billing module, but we haven't done the reporting module yet, that might be all you need. There's different ways of visualising that.
Yeah. But where I've seen dysfunctional walls is that people think the stories are, you know, 2 or 3 weeks long. Work that is just impossible to show that it is done inside of the iteration.
So what do you think that is? Why?
I think maybe people don't understand that the stories need to be at a layer that you can demonstrate value inside of the iteration, that you should be able to make achievements.
But when somebody argues you that point, because most people argue the point truly and honestly believe that their point, their way of working is...
That it can't be broken down?
Or just the fact that, oh, this whole agile thing is silly. You know, I've always done things in the past. I can go, if I go away for 4 weeks instead of breaking this thing down, I'm going to be far more effective than breaking this down. So,
well, you're not demonstrating progress. You've got no visibility about where you're at. You can't get that feedback loop from an end user about what on earth's happening and making sure that you're on the right track.
I think that's the case. I think people that try it, you see they break cards down the wrong way, which means they don't really get the feedback loop anyway.
Yeah.
The dysfunction I've seen quite a lot is, you know, you see 5 cards on the wall all moving along together. So essentially they broke things down into 3-day cards, but essentially they're moving all 15-day cards. And then they wonder why they get nothing finished at the end of the iteration. It's because, you know, they're not taking that thin slice through the system. They're just, you know, they've broken things down for the sake of looking like they're agile and moving things across the wall.
So the other thing that I don't like about walls sometimes is the lack of tokens. I really think tokens can be quite valuable. And so what I mean by tokens are sort of indicators that you attach to cards. So, for example, that there's a risk associated with this card or there's a blockage with the card. I like indicating new cards. So scope that's being added in, I'll actually put a new sticker on it so that you can see quite visibly some scope creep that's happened in the last iteration. Not that you've put it inside of the iteration, but you've put it into the backlog so that people have that visibility and can have a look at that particular card. The other things are expedites as they come through, so special requests from upper management. I like to indicate that and visualise that and record that on the card so that we can provide some metrics later.
Yeah, to me, the metrics one is the big one, is that we're usually pretty rubbish taking metrics. I watched a team the other day where they were putting a check mark on a card every day it had been sitting on the wall, but I don't think anyone there actually understood what they were going to do with that metric at the end of it. They were told it would be good to take, you know, how many days it had been stagnant there, but if you're not going to turn that into some sort of reporting mechanism and improve yourself from it, then there was going to be a real point in the first place.
Yeah.
So anything you can do to... if you're going to take metrics, make sure you take them for the right reason, right?
Yep.
But either I see people doing it and don't understand why they're doing it, or worse, not doing it at all.
I would only do some of these things if I suspected that there was a particular problem. Say, for example, that you were continually waiting on another unit to provide you information. So I would put a date at the time it goes to that area, and then the date that it comes back into your flow, as an example, and then actually provide a graph about how they're not meeting your expectations from a service level agreement.
But even on a Kanban wall, right, is that in order to track your cycle time, then you want to track the data comes in and the data goes out.
Well, you want to track more than that. You actually want to track the transitions inside of each
Well, yeah, yeah. But you all at the very least, you want to put dates on there, right?
Yep.
So getting the team into the habit of doing that, how many teams do you actually see where you come along and there's dates filled in for every card, right? It's only the better teams that tend to do that. I see so many where they all of a sudden have forgotten to take a date somewhere because they're not in that habit of you know, putting something up on the card.
Okay.
The other thing, which is kind of a little bit unrelated, but you know, we're having this debate last week in an iteration management course is whether you walk the wall or whether you go around and do the traditional, this is what I did yesterday, this is what I'm doing today type thing.
Yeah.
And the dysfunctions that you see, because the dysfunction is that if everybody goes around and talks, sometimes, right, it's unclear because people are jumping all over the wall, right? Here's the one in development, here's the one
in... You should always be touching the cards.
Sure, but people are jumping all over the wall. They're looking, you know, because each person's talking and all of a sudden they're talking about a card that's in development and they're talking about a card that's in test. Right? There's a couple of things that, you know, and people's eyes jump across the wall. So lots of people argue with me saying it's better to walk the wall from right to left to... Yeah, and I've seen lots of teams do that. But the problem with that is that people start talking to each card, and then you can't actually figure out who's doing what during the day, whether even everyone in the team has actually had a chance to speak up. Mm-hmm. And you know, even if someone's, you know, sometimes you keep hearing the same person talking, you go, hang on, how many cards are you actually working on? So you've got to be quite aware of the way that you talk to the wall.
Is the happy medium something in between?
Yeah, look, I still, as much as I see it, I still kind of like the everybody talk. But if you do it in a bit more of a structured manner, then you might get more of it. I think
so
a lot
how,
of us...
How do you pick up cards that haven't moved, that no one's talked to?
Well, if I'm playing the role of the iteration manager or someone who's the coach, then I'm kind of really looking for those. You know, it's a, if you've ever, I always talk about it, it reminds me of air traffic control, right? You know all the planes that are in the sky.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you go, hang on, is that plane flying into a mountain? You kind of know. It's kind of the brain that, you know, when I'm doing iteration management, being Scrum Master, they're the kind of things that I'm looking for. So I just kind of see it. But I see plenty of teams that sit there and just, you know, are just going through the motions. Right? Which comes back to, is it really a dead wall? Because they're just standing in front of it going, I'm going to look good in front of my manager, I'll talk to this thing. But then they go back to their desk and they don't even work on those things anyway.
Right? Dead walls, guys, don't do it.
Mm. And dead stand-ups are a good indication sometimes of a dead wall.
Mm.
Very good. Now, last but not least for the day is our tool.
Yeah, we were talking about Red Critter Tracker.
Yes, www.redcrittertracker.com.
I'd seen about this a little while ago and thought that I'd go back and have a play, and finally had the opportunity to have a play with it.
Agile tool gamification is their tagline.
Yes, and really they're trying to do something different. They're trying to apply those gaming techniques, and it is a tool for managing your stories, but it could be for managing many different types of things. It's quite customizable in a number of elements about the terminology that it uses. It took me a little while to get used to it. It wasn't out of the box very user-friendly. It took a little bit to set up.
It's not quite intuitive, particularly how to set up projects and things. I found was a little bit backwards.
Yeah, they do have a help file that tells you the steps that you need to do to set up, but even then going through that, I sort of got a little bit lost. At around about the 15-minute mark, I hated it. And around about the 20-minute mark, I loved it.
Yeah, so what to you is the killer feature in this tool? I mean, because it does all the stock standard stuff, right? Is that, you know, that you expect.
The thing that really got me was
projects, it's got tasks, it's got a story wall, you move cards, so it's got all that.
So it's the rewards.
Hmm.
The really kooky rewards. So, you know, you could be doing anything and then amazingly you get this pop-up going, oh, you've got this achievement.
So I got achievement just for signing in. So there's
all these really weird achievements. There's a weekend warrior achievement. So that's for signing in on the weekend to get that achievement, which is probably not a good thing.
No, I was going to say, I think you want to penalise that.
But there were just a lot of achievements, and I thought it was quite cute. And you can probably set up your own reward system, such as when you finish your story.
So if you're trying to visualise this, it's a reward system very much like Foursquare or those kind of systems where, you know, once you hit a certain amount of targets, it gives you a badge, essentially. That's just what we mean by rewards here.
Yeah, but not only that, when you create a story, you can allocate a reward associated with completing that story. And so you gather up
points,
and then you get rewards at the end of the day for a certain number of points being hit. I'm not quite sure how that works. I never got to the 100-point mark.
There's a reward store, and I think the interesting thing about this is that, and I didn't quite get to the bottom of this, is that there's rewards that the company itself offers, but you can also offer your own rewards. So I wonder whether there's kind of a two thing at play here. One is that, I mean, you can say to your team, look, if you get 100 points, then, you know, pizza's on us, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's just to drive people to get completion. And if you do check-ins, you get this, you know, so you can put those kind of rewards into the system. But there's also these ones that are rewards that come from the company. And I wonder whether they're actually going to game company against company.
Yeah.
In some way, shape or form.
What I liked about it was that, A, you could actually change the terminology. So you can use Scrum terms, which is what it's set to via default, or you can use your own terms.
Did you see any Kanban in there? I couldn't find anything that allowed me to do whip limits or anything easily.
I didn't see that. You could change the flow whatsoever. So there was a flow. It was to do, doing, done, basically. I don't think that's actually what they labelled it, but in essence, that's what it was. I did find the whole relationship of how you set up a project and a release, the stories and then the tasks, a bit kooky. You had to have, by default, out-of-the-box tasks inside of a release before you can actually move them through the flow. When I started changing that mentally, so that tasks were actually stories and stories were features, it worked a lot better for me. So basically what they had out of the box was that tasks were the things that were moving through the flow, which I can understand, but I always like to keep a story as something that you actually move through the flow rather than a task.
Yeah, I mean that's actually really the traditional Mike Cohen definition, right? It's that, you know, the story is the thing and there's lots of tasks, so they've kind of taken that to heart.
Yeah.
I see fewer and fewer people actually using that. Lots of people use tasks. But
what's so nice about it is that you could just change the terminology, which I did, and then everything just fitted into place. And that was around about that 20-minute mark. As soon as I changed stories to features and tasks to stories, it just mentally worked brilliant for me. It took me a while to work out how to shift a story around. You know, the way that it worked on my screen, the little tag to handle it was a bit hard to see, and I didn't actually know how to do that. Saving was a bit clunky as well.
I think it was the whole adding tasks thing. There's quite a number of clicks in order to you got into add a task, and that descended a little bit. You can't just sort of log in the way you go. You've kind of got to get through, get in, get into your project, get further into the world. It seems to be built more around the social part as being your dashboard.
Yes, yeah.
And the tasks were a little bit secondary, so that the main screen has got, it's got activity history, and it looks very much like a Twitter feed.
Yes, it is very much. It's a project feed that you can have, which I actually thought was a nice idea to put a sort of social networking element into the project. I'm curious about how well it would work.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, Jira, Greenhopper have had that for a long time, as have, you know, a bunch of the other tools. So,
and how much do you see it used?
Well, it happens automatically. Like it writes the feed out for everything that happens on the
right
on the wall. So,
but this on top of it lets you add your own feed items to it, but also you get your rewards and your badges added to the feed as well.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I don't know how it integrates things like, you know, Twitter and Yammer and some of those tools, which might be more interesting, because, you know, do you have to opt out of those to use this as your primary feed, or can you intermix those things that are coming through your Twitter feed as well?
It has burn down charts, but they're in either hours or points. You can't actually have the two together.
It's not bad. I guess the downside is that it's a per user payment model, which really irks me about some of these tools. I mean, I know that's the way you monetize this stuff, but it's $5.99 a user per month. It's a 330-day trial that you can start with, but to me, the tools are in that kind of price range. It's okay for small teams, but they just don't scale to enterprise. I assume there's probably something you do if you're an enterprise, but you know, if you're a small 20-man team, which is probably where this is marketed at anyway, right? That might work out okay, but I mean, if you think of that, it's, you know, that's what, $50 a month, and you know, starts to hang up. So
you can use the cloud, or you can install it on your own server from a security perspective.
Yeah, that's a plus for me. That's a lot. Not enough tools do that. It is Microsoft driven. I don't know when you install it, whether you can run it on any other platform. I didn't look that close into it. I was just using the hosted one, but it is a Microsoft framework tool. So I'm assuming if you're going to install it yourself, you're probably a little limited.
Yeah, browser-wise, you can use IE7, 8, 9, Firefox, Safari, Chrome, and Opera.
And it works on an iPad.
Does it?
Yes, it works.
I didn't even, because I looked at the browsers and I thought, no, I'm not going to try it on an iPad.
Yeah, no, it did work reasonably well. I didn't try dragging cards across, so I didn't get that far, but everything else didn't really hang up, so I assumed using something behind the scenes.
So it's certainly a tool that's different and interesting.
Yeah, kudos to them for bringing something out differently. Whether it's going to take the world by storm, I don't exactly know. I suspect, I mean, for other tools, I can expect those kind of things being added in. I know I use quite a lot of Jira, and I could see how you could do this in Jira if you really wanted to. So, yeah, good for them to try something different. And that's about all the time we have. Anything else, Renee?
No. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yes, we'll see you all next time. Hopefully, will Tony be back by the next podcast, or will we still be lying on a beach?
Tony will be back, but I might not be here.
Ah, geez, I don't know. Hard to get with you guys. Well, for whoever's here at the next one. By the way, if you've got anything that you want to talk to us about, you can get us on the email.
podcast@theagilerevolution.com.
We can get Renee directly at
Renee@theagilerevolution.com.
Or me, Craig@theagilerevolution.com. And that's not a very good Tony voice, is it? Tony@theagilerevolution.com. I can't impersonate Tony. Can you impersonate Tony? Very good. And on that note, we'll see you later.
Bye.